Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Laura Adamczyk, author of Hardly Children, a collection of short stories, and her first book, published by FSG Originals in November. Laura was born, raised, and lives in Illinois. Her writing has appeared in the Chicago Reader, Ninth Letter, Washington Square Review, and many other periodicals and collections. She earned her MFA in fiction from the University of Illinois. Hardly Children is an eerie and frankly scary collection, at times, of stories that loosely but thematically, both with children and without, weave a skein of thrill, loss, dread, Kafkaesque stuff, seemingly meaningless until you think about it afterwards, and stories of life bereft of hope, confusing but somehow transcendent. So you come away from this book learning something about yourself, whether you like it or not, and finding out that if you haven't been given the key to the story, but rather an unanswered question or a void where you might expect a period or an exclamation mark, you actually are kind of entranced and kind of not happy. You're kind of looking forward to thinking about it. In all, I've never read anything like it, and I was upset when I read the last page. I even dreamed the book, because since I'm old, sometimes when I fall asleep with the book on my chest. But anyway, with that, welcome, Laura, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, first question, and what we may have briefly talked about before, is why has your entire life been spent in Illinois?
It's really kind of strange. Like, at a certain point, it's, you know, something that you notice that is going on. I especially noticed it as far as, I think, like, my education goes, and that, you know, I went to a small college in Illinois, and then, you know, I spent some time at Northwestern, and then got my MFA down at University of Illinois in Urbana, and it was kind of around that time where I was like, oh, wow, I'm kind of spending some time here, and I don't know if I have a great answer for that besides it just kind of happened. And I think, you know, Chicago, where I live now, has a lot to do with that, you know, it could be one of those situations where the city really, you know, fit my temperament, or it kind of shapes my temperament. But Chicago has been a really great place for me to live over the past, you know, decade or so. And so I think that's it has a lot to do with why I've stayed in Illinois for so long.
So now you're going to go on book tours. Who knows where you'll end up? Maybe you'll change.
I'll always come back.
So your characters take notice of children, sometimes in an unusual way or manner, whether they're swinging on a playground or lying on the ground bleeding. So before we get into the stories themselves, what gave rise to this feeling that you had about your characters, especially those kind of watching children, interacting with them, you know?
I think it kind of has to do, or I think, like, in the first story, the narrator herself kind of says it, where she says something like, people will assume that all women my age have, you know, strong feelings about children in one way or the other. And I think that's kind of part of it, that there is this sort of strong societal expectation of women to either become mothers or sort of come out very strongly against, like, I'm never going to, you know, parent a child, absolutely not. And I think it was partly that awareness where I felt like sometimes I could, if I was ever interacting with children, sometimes I felt myself kind of being watched from other people, you know, with this sort of, like, gleeful expectation, like, oh, you seem to be having fun, like, throwing this ball to this kid. Maybe you could have a child. And so it's ever that, you know, that simple. So I think that's certainly part of it.
So why, then with the title, which comes out of a line in your stories, and also kind of goes with the cover of the book, which the cover of the book is really cool. Why is it, and like I said, it's a line in the story, why is it hardly children? Are we supposed to take that in a couple of different ways?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal, I think, with any title, for me at least, is that it has, you know, kind of bigger, a more complex meaning than the way that one could originally read it. But, I mean, in the story that it comes from specifically, the phrase hardly children is kind of, it's a little bit more specific. It's a way of, you know, the people in the story kind of diminishing children and saying, well, this is from the story Too Much a Child, where children are getting stolen from their homes, and there are people who want to say that that's a justifiable thing to happen to them, in part because the children themselves might be dangerous. Well, so saying hardly children is a way to kind of make them seem like, well, they're basically adults. They're hardly kids. They're these more adult, kind of more dangerous beings. But I think over the course of the collection, having all these stories come together, the title has also expanded.
You know, I looked at the soundtrack. This is not really a question, but I looked at the soundtrack for your book, and I, like I said, I'm old, so I recognize Prince, Neil Young, Joe Cocker, ELO, the Pixies, who I love, Talking mm-hmm. Heads. But I missed a few, though, but I listened to all of them, and they all were really good. I'm just telling you that. So if we look at the first story, the title's in all caps, Wanted. And a lot of the questions I ask, I want to make sure I don't do any spoilers, but... we have a woman who does something the reader feels is perfectly innocuous, but then seems to have, like, the probability of terrifying consequences. And that's what I mentioned when we spoke at the beginning again also. What's the reader to think? Like, again, being careful, you know, she kind of won't resist, but then she might. So at the end, I'm thinking... well, maybe this, maybe that. And that's kind of the theme of the ending lines of almost all the stories in this book. And I like that. Some people like their stories wrapped up in a box with a ribbon, and these aren't. And was that your goal? Was it just the way you write?
I think it's kind of a reflection of my own... just kind of general aesthetic when it comes to, you know, not just writing, but I think art in general, is that I like to have this in-between feeling of not being certain about a thing. You know, that with that first story especially, I wanted, you know, two things to be possible at once. You know, this perhaps innocuous situation happening, and then perhaps something kind of more insidious going on. And I think for me, it just fills me with kind of this kind of uneasy energy that I find more satisfying than a clear-cut ending or a clear-cut emotion. You know, I want something to be both, you know, funny and tragic, or potentially normal but also very strange, like, you know, to have two different seemingly contradictory feelings come together at the same time is very exciting to me.
Do you ever decide when you're writing what actually happened, like the reader kind of has to?
I think it depends on the story, but I think I've probably in some ways, in certain stories, make a decision, and that will kind of lead to me suggesting things maybe a little bit more strongly in one direction or the other. But I do ultimately like the feeling of it being up to the reader.
Well, it's like girls. You know, you have three sisters, which is kind of something that you follow up later, you know, oldest, middle, youngest, all with different memories of what may or may not have happened. And then the reader, again, has to pick a side, so to speak. But the reader has the advantage, or whatever, disadvantage, of not knowing whether the protagonist is a reliable narrator at all, whether there was a couch, whether there was a three-piece suit, whether there was an itch that needed to be scratched, or even whether there was a little girl there or not. And each of the sisters have their own suggestion as to what happened. So I found that one of the most intriguing ones, because I spent a lot of time thinking, well, like, where was the grandmother? You know, I'm thinking all kinds of things. And I find that very intriguing, and I also, well, you kind of explained it, but it's just you don't come across that kind of writing every day, and I think it's great. But do you find it unique, or do you find it, like I was saying earlier, like Kafkaesque, or in the one story, like Chekhov? You know, do you have someone you kind of, something you kind of feel like I want to be like?
I feel like there's a, you know, there's dozens of writers that I would like to emulate in one way or the other, but I can't say that there's ever anybody I'm looking at so directly at any given moment. I think just because things like, you know, kind of inspiration and influence, you know, for me it's come from years of reading and, you know, falling in love with stories and then sort of forgetting about them for, you know, 7 years or something like that, and all of a sudden I'll recognize something from a writer that in something that I've written. And so it's, I don't know, to me it's like that influence from other writers can have this kind of long gestation period, no pun intended.
Well, all right, next is Too Much a Child, and the title again suggests, as we talked about, that someone is more than a child than they should be, and it did remind me of the Prince song. And you're young, so where did you come up with a phrase like a red mouth full of cottage cheese? Did that just come to you? I mean, it's a strange but very explanatory way of telling someone what it looked like.
Yeah, that's kind of the simplest explanation for that is that, you know, I was trying to describe how it looks to see, you know, that kind of wound, and I wanted something that felt evocative and that a reader wouldn't want to see themselves
looking at that necessarily. And then, you know, you do it again because you make this boy so perfect and so morally straight, and then you have her pinching the toe of the sneaker and wiggling it, and it's like, oh, all these things are the same. They're all like, yeah, it reminds me of something that happened in my life that someone could have looked one way or looked the other, like I said earlier. But this is the story I felt more like it was almost like science fiction. So, like, what, explain to me, again, without trying to spoil anything, well, you don't have to answer because it might spoil it. What are the new crowd control devices like? There's bloodshed. You know, I know what the little truncheons are and the shields and the helmets and all that, but that second device that they have, you came up with that. And, you know, that was, what is it?
I don't know. I think in the context of the story, I wanted it to be new, but in my head, it's really just a sword. And
yeah, it's so nasty.
I wanted it to be a sword because it's kind of insane. Like, it would be crazy for, you know, policemen to use swords on people today, and yet they use much worse.
Yeah. Yeah, look at Rwanda. I mean, God. Yeah, so anyway, that's a good answer. There's a couple of times in the book, and maybe two stories I can think of, where the end is near. Yeah, I think I'm doing pretty good not spoiling it. Yet, there's a feeling, there's not a feeling of fear as this guy is walking towards the two of them. There's almost a longing or a desire that's completed. You do it twice, and it seems like almost, I don't know, it's definitely sensual, and in one case, almost sexual. And it's like, who the hell thinks about their demise in such a way, and why?
I think, well, in the context of this story specifically, I think people who might think about their demises in that way are those who are constantly fearing it. And so for it to finally come to them, it can almost feel like a relief that they don't have to keep on fearing this awful thing. It's like, ah, the awful thing has finally happened. Now I don't have to worry so much anymore.
I can see that. I can see that. It's funny, like my mom's 96 years old, and, you know, she'll say things like, I'm failing. And it's such a nice thing to say, because she doesn't say it with any, like, feeling of fear at all. And the thing that's cool about it is, for 66 years I've made her laugh, and for 66 years she's made me laugh, and we laugh at death. And I think as long as you can laugh at death, I think it's pretty cool. Yeah, we joke about all kinds of end times and things that would happen afterwards. And I think it's really nice to be able to do that. And I think she's a very courageous woman because of it.
Absolutely. I think keeping a sense of humor throughout one's life, I applaud that so much. I hope I'm able to do that.
Me too. Me too. And, you know, it's something I think about, but I don't know how I'll be. It's just like when people ask, you know, if there's a rushing train and the girl's in front of it, are you going to run and cross, throw her out of the way and all that? You'd think you would.
Or will you pull like a George Costanza and like push other people out of the way so you can survive?
Yeah, and it's on videotape.
Right.
And the clown is there.
Right.
You know, I have this bookstore, and, you know, I hire these people, but I always have to have one person working for me that really knows Seinfeld, because every day something happens in my bookstore that's exactly like an episode, and I have to turn to someone and say, remember? And if there's no one there, it really irritates me.
Yeah, it's almost like they're kind of like your own, like, camera that you're talking to. Like, you can make some significant eye contact. It's almost like The Office, but it's, like, it's very reassuring to have somebody be like, yep.
Yeah, it's, like, funny. Like, there'll be, sometimes there's people that come into my bookstore, and they'll get, like, one of the rare books, and they'll bring it up to the front, and they'll go, this is way too much. And I go, okay, pay whatever you think it's worth. And they go, what do you mean? I said, no, whatever, well, pay whatever you think it's worth. And if they're a Republican, they'll go, well, I guess I could just take it for nothing then. I said, yeah, if you want to, go ahead. And one guy did. He just walked out with it.
Oh, my gosh.
And I figure, you know, it's karma. It'll come around.
Yeah, he doesn't sound like he's probably that happy in the rest of his life.
No, it's funny, because if I was told, if I said it was too much and they said, pay whatever you want, I would pay more than what they had asked for. It seemed like the logical thing to do.
Yeah, that would also really stick it to them, too.
Yeah, it would. Okay, moving on. So gun control, while you're listening to Powderfinger, which seems logical, is you actually, not steal, but you use as the basis of your story the Chekhov idea, which I'm not spoiling anything, which leaves the reader hanging. If you have a gun in the first act, it's got to go off in the third act. And so, but at the end, again, being very careful, is it like someone going, as people do, he was a loner, they use his middle name, they say he seemed like a nice guy, kind of kept to himself, never would have suspected this. Is that what you're getting at the end?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's really spoiling too much, but at some point in the writing of that story, you know, Chekhov's gun is kind of this mandate about how plot is supposed to go. And, you know, it's kind of it's like a pithy little thing to say to somebody, you know, if there's a gun in Act 1 fired in Act 3. But it's also kind of prescriptive. It's saying, you know, this is kind of a rule that you have to follow. But during the writing of that story, like, pretty quickly, I realized that, you know, as we so often see when there is some kind of mass shooting in this country, is that there is a script that is followed with how those acts are talked about and how they're treated, and it becomes incredibly predictable, and there's it's almost to the point of it being mundane, and there's a great tragedy in the way that, you know, guns in this country have become so kind of just easy to predict, really, like how things are going to play out and how people are going to react.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, just kind of realizing, you know, the way that those acts and plot can so frequently just be boring.
So then, okay. Do you mind me going through these stories? Is that okay?
Yeah, this is great.
Okay, so Wine is Mostly Water, and you combine two completely different themes, which we would never think what the themes are, and I also want to know what slender part of this story came from your old boyfriend.
What were the two themes that you thought were coming together?
Well, you have him going back to sit on the bench with his dad with his lemonade, telling him what he tells him. And you also have this incredible, but I think something that actually exists, guy, you know, suspended.
I think the story kind of really started out with that image. I don't really know where it came from for me, but I just, that image kind of came into my head, and I thought, okay, I'm going to write a story about a man who would, you know, put himself through this kind of performance. And the part that actually came from an old boyfriend was that I had dated somebody for some time who found out in his early 30s that he was adopted. And those two things just kind of came together for me in that story, you know, this feeling of being suspended and kind of needing, kind of reaching a point in your life where there's a sort of, where you just kind of realize that you might not know who you are or who you thought you were has changed, and sort of it being in that position of transition, I guess.
And what's funny is, up to that point, you kind of say, okay, well, I get the whole thing. And then you do what you do, and he looks down, and I guess his sister is Sandy. I guess it's Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
He looks at Sandy, and she's whispering to the curator. And I'm going, ah, damn it, she's doing it again. Because it's like, all right, what in God's name is she saying to her, and why are they laughing? What is it? What? You know what I mean? It's like, you just did that.
Mm-hmm. I liked the feeling in that one of the way that women who are strangers to each other, who share, who have like a man in common in their lives, will find a way to form an alliance between the two of them for whatever reason. And I liked the feeling of him sort of being outside of that, but then that the alliance, like the friendship or alliance or whatever between the two women, potentially being something that could be kind of nurturing for him in the end, even though he might be the kind of person who would resist it.
I like is it Gus? Is that his name?
Who's that?
It's not Gus. The guy who wheels the platform out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I liked him.
Guy.
And I like the fact that he wanted to be like him. So Danny Girl, It was. I didn't get the title and I didn't get her name, but is it because of Danny Boy, the song, or is it just...
Her name is Danny, and I wanted it... I think I just kind of wanted that playfulness in a story that doesn't have a ton of playfulness in it.
Yeah, okay. Also, the word fedor, which I had to look up, so it's Portuguese meaning stink or smelly, but there's also Fedor Emelianenko, who is the most feared fighter in the MMA.
I did not know that.
So I thought, well, it could be either one, but I guess it's the stinky part. But I've never heard it. I've never encountered that word before. You must have found it somewhere.
It could have been on thesaurus.com. most of the words I know are from
there. It's a good one because it really does. It is evocative. And Margaret, you know, I feel sorry for Margaret. You know, she really gets screwed. No pun intended at the end. And the fact that once again, the reader doesn't necessarily know what's happening to her, but in this epistolary fashion, but you pretty much guess it, right? I mean, you know exactly what happened to her.
Yeah, I think we pretty much know what's going on with Margaret, more or less, unfortunately. She thinks she's getting what she wants, but then I don't think it's going to go well for her.
Yeah. And the idea repeated in the short story about breasts goes along with the cover of the book to a certain extent. And I think some other review mentioned that too, or at least mentioned the cover of the book and that being an aspect of the cover. But the thing that got me the most is the thing that I already talked about, which is repeated in Too Much a Child, is this idea in the attic of, and I won't say what it's called, but this idea that, and again, it was sensual. Actually, it was almost sexual. Again, this idea of something so precious. You know, it was like the best thing that could possibly happen to you, like going to the circus or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I also think. Well, at least in the context of that story, I think it was like hinting at, you know, a very sort of dark feeling that for some people, like, death will be welcome. You know, if they might be able to see the way that their lives might be going, and
but she's
so
a little,
far it's not good.
But she's a little girl. Although, oh yeah, it's the other thing. In like three stories, I think the girls, usually girls, get some money, and then they go out and buy all this crap. They buy, like, and I, you know, I know all the crap because I have four kids, who are all grown up now, pretty much. But yeah, and it's never chocolate. It's always like warheads or crybabies or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think, like, I don't know that many kids who are really into, you know, like, artisanal chocolate yet. I think that kind of, like, waits. I think that comes later on in life. Like, at least for me, when I was a kid, I wanted, like, the most kind of, like, harsh, acidic, astringent, like, Sour Patch Kids, where it felt like your mouth was being kind of, like...
It's horrible.
Like, eaten away by... Like, it's terrible. It's terrible that these foods even exist.
Well, I was driving with my kids in the car, and my son, while I was driving along, put a warhead into my coffee, and I drank it, and then I spit it out of the window, except the window was closed. I never got it. I'm sorry. all right, so, intermission. And one without no children.
Mm-hmm.
And also one with my hero, J.D. I mean, how many heroes are in this book? I mean, I wish I could act like that. And I've been in situations where I haven't acted like that, where I've been the pacifist or thought to myself, why would I do something like this? Whereas he doesn't even think. He just clocks him.
Yeah,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then she takes off. A lot of people take off.
Yeah, her heart is broken. So she goes for a walk.
Yeah, and her interior monologue is, again, like, happiness being missing, or you find it in a strange way, or it appears kind of in an almost, not perverted, in an almost inverted way. And as in Powderfinger, the story modifies itself till, mm-hmm. again, the reader can't be sure which version is correct or if there's any version really at all. I mean, you really slid around.
Yeah, I have a special place in my heart for that story, in part because it doesn't kind of fit with, you know, there's no kids in there, and I don't think it gets quite as dark as some of the other ones, but also because of the way that, like you were saying, like, it presents itself and then it kind of erases itself too.
Yeah.
And I love when characters go to movies.
You love when they go to movies, you love when they drink, you love when they like beards.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
They're all great activities.
Yeah, like, so Here Comes Your Man, you know, what is with the beard? But the other thing is, I love the way that family restaurant is family restaurant. That's mm-hmm. that's my sense of humor. And you must have gotten a chuckle out of it, too.
I think in part because that was the name of a restaurant in my town growing up. It was family restaurant. Like, it didn't really have a name.
Your family restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And also in Here Comes Your Man, or Here Comes Your Man is a Velvet Underground song, but I wasn't sure you were thinking of that. I don't know.
Well, it's actually Pixies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. But I think of it because of...
Waiting for My Man.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I always think of alt band names, too. We even at the bookstore have a book of alt band names and titles of novels and stuff, like Lil Donnie, or The Friends Society, or The Last Days of Mankind. And the other thing is, like, not too many people would stare at Lincoln's crotch. I mean, they'd stare at David, I think, but, you know, Lincoln's? I mean, and then I also like that she puts up her hand and waves. Because
mm-hmm.
she's really funny.
Yeah, She's kind of living a little recklessly, but not completely without charm.
Well, I kind of feel sorry for the virgin, but then he's kind of a ass anyway, in a way. But he's like he's like a regular guy, though, but she's not going to accept a regular guy.
No, I thought after writing the story a few years later, that movie Obvious Child came out.
Oh, yeah.
Seen that with Jenny Slate. And it sort of reminded me of, like, a similar dynamic where, you know, she's a little bit acerbic and maybe a little bit of a mess and maybe not, you know, used to be being treated very well from men. And then this guy comes along, he's just like, yeah, I'm just like a nice, regular guy. And it's like she doesn't really know what to do with that.
It's funny, my ex-wife memorized every word of Airplane, as did my daughter. And they also did Dumb and Dumber, too. But so all my life, it's been, you know, when I say Shirley, you know, it's like, it gets old after a while, but it's been said every single time I've said it.
That movie is so rich with lines to be quoted, and there's just so many bits in it that, yeah, it's kind of overflowing.
Well, it's like going back to Seinfeld, like you and I do, you know, it's kind of like, you can always go there because there's a line that fits.
Mm-hmm.
And the other cool thing is how in the truck she kind of goes berserk in a happy way at the end. And I had a girlfriend like that once. She would get drunk, and then I couldn't get her into the car. And she would keep, like, running around it. And it always took two guys to catch her. And then when she would be pushed into the car, we would pull out, and she'd jump out of the car.
That sounds amusing, yet also dangerous.
But it was, you know, it was like in this, it was really funny, but after a while it got really irritating. Which was why.
Yeah, you gotta. It's hard to wrangle those people sometimes.
Yeah, and she liked to. She liked to get drunk. Well, she was drunk. Okay, so give and go. So that's a basketball term, and really, this is like the closest to flash fiction. Not necessarily in its length, which is quite short, but in the idea of kind of like one scene, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And. But it packs a punch, again, no pun intended, because, this is why I can't say anything, because it's so short, whatever I say, I'll spoil it. okay.
I felt like that might have been, like, one of the most sort of tender stories in the collection, where... It always comes as a surprise to me where I'm not trying to go for something darker and creepier and more, I guess I don't want to say complicated because I feel like things that are a little bit more positive can be complicated as well, but I'm always surprised when that's where I land with a story is something a little bit, yeah, more like tender and not, not quite as creepy.
Yeah, it's like, it's cool the way he hangs from the basket after he dunks it. And then looking at her, you know, you kind of think, well, is, you know, maybe there's love. Maybe it's love, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, and needless to say, I would say it's really hard to make sentences out of hair on your shower wall. I mean, have you ever tried it?
I have. And I mean, it doesn't really work, and that's, I guess, that's a big part of the point, is that one sister thinks that she's communicating in this kind of fun way with her sister, and the other one's like, I can't understand a word you're saying. What are you even talking about?
Well, I like the way her sister, even at the end, when she goes, all right, now we're cooking, or now we're going, when she throws mm-hmm. the mug. You know, she's got such a great sense of humor. And what I really liked also was the books she reads and the librarian was also another nice guy. There's another nice guy in your book, librarian. Yeah, she goes, now we're talking. Okay, like in The Summer Father, well, I was going to say about buy crappy food and all. And I don't really see how he slips those dollars out, because where are they? If they're in his pocket or in his wallet, it's like, you know, it's kind of a pain in the butt. Unless he has a whole stack of them back there.
There's just money everywhere.
But when he says, spread my ashes here, it reminds me of my dad, because he... And my grandfather, because they like this Yardley aftershave lotion. And it's a white label. It's really hard to find. And he, as he was almost dying, he had this little bit left of Yardley. And we were alone, and he said, okay, when I go, can you splash some of this on my face?
Oh, my gosh.
And I did. Now I'm going to cry now. But, yeah, so I did. I went into the room where... at the funeral home where his coffin was, and just did that. It made me feel like, not only was it like closure, but it was like, you know, I was proud of the fact that he would be proud of me, or something like that, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's hard sometimes to have those kinds of moments when you're kind of so deep into a loss or grief that, yeah, it's, I think people wouldn't be surprised at how meaningful those gestures can be.
Which leads nicely into Black Box, because, you know, I have songs that I've told people to sing at my funeral, like Gimme Shelter or Layla. But mm-hmm. but the problem with Gimme Shelter is that, you know, they say rape, murder. It's just, I'm thinking, should I really be playing this at my funeral, you know? But no one knows, they can't hear that really, they don't understand. No. And the other thing I have is, I won't be there. It's just an empty stage. I'm gonna tell my brothers, get the best sound system in the world. Play the song. Don't say anything before. Don't say anything after. Just confuse the hell out of everybody in there. And the other one I have is, my nephews have agreed to this, is that I'm in the audience. they just sit me down next to them, like Weekend at Bernie's or something, and I'm just there, and sometimes I feel like I'm interviewing myself. The thing about go ahead, you should talk.
No, I hope you're taking good notes of all these suggestions.
I know. I feel like I should be able to write a book, but then my mother says you don't have a book in you, which is one of the nicer things she said to me.
Oh.
It all rolls off my back. I like the fact that when she was in the bar, she wasn't afraid. I was thinking she'd be afraid. And then she goes off with them, like, you know, the three guys in the Revolutionary War with the flute and the bandage on his head and all that. And she just goes heading off into the sunset with them. That was nice.
Yeah, to me, that was the ending of that story. It's just like, oh, well, she's with her people now. Like, this is her crew. These are the people that she feels comfortable with, is the degenerates in the bar talking about death.
Yeah, and the juxtaposition is anybody else reading this is going to go, oh, this is not going to end well, you know?
And it might not. I mean, in my envisioning of the story, any peril that would await her is not from those two men, but some, you know, the larger world, or, you know, potentially specific other people in a particular neighborhood or something like that. But it wasn't from the two of them, because the three of them had shared so much, it was really just sharing alcohol and some stories.
So that's all the stories. So here's a dream I had when I was reading your book, and then I put it on my chest. I had this dream. It's going to sound boring, and it came from your book, but I when I went back through it, I couldn't find the spot or why I dreamt this. I dreamt this dream where everything was disorganized, like the universe was born in a state of disorder rather than order. So like entropy had reversed itself. So when you were a character, it was all wrong. You got combined with somebody else's character, and what they were thinking was what you just, something like what you were just thinking, but it was completely off. And it got so confusing, because the tail end of you was the beginning of somebody else, but there was no correlation between the two. And the dream made me like really confused, and kind of really like you couldn't hang on to reality. And there was a passage in one of your stories, but I can't remember where it was. You probably can't either.
I feel like that could explain a lot of the stories, or fit with a lot of the stories. Maybe, let's see, I'm looking at the table of contents. There's a part in Girls where, I think it's Girls, where the narrator is talking about knowing the rooms of her house in the dark. Or, no, things have shifted, yeah.
Right, that's what it was.
I think that is Girls, where she's talking about that feeling of disorientation, and it's seeming like things in her house have moved without her moving them.
Yeah, that's what it was. All right. Well, thanks for listening to me.
Oh, thank you.
So I, like you know, since I told you, I have this independent bookstore, and your book would be right up there on the front table. And what I do when I like a book a real lot is I say to people, here, buy this. If you don't like it, bring it back.
Oh, great.
And they won't bring it back because it's too good. So anyway, thanks so much for being here. And I really look forward to hearing a lot more about you in the future. It's a great first book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
So we were talking with Laura Adamczyk about her new book, actually her first book, which comes out in paperback, so you guys can all afford it. You don't have to wait till it's in paperback out of hardback. Hardly Children, weird stories, but really, really good stories. It's not that you'll like them so much, but each one is a book, a story that you'll be glad that you read. And it's so nice when you get an author whose first book is this good. A lot of authors, when their first book comes out, their agents tell them, write a book of short stories before you write a novel. And I'm really glad she did. And I'm sure she will write a novel soon. So that was great. So upcoming authors, we have rebroadcast here at the station, which you can just listen to again on podcast, which is the National Book Award finalist Tommy Orange, who's going to talk about his book There, which came out of nowhere and then all of a sudden is like in the top 10 for weeks. And then this guy who is an organization guru, Ryder Carroll, will discuss what is his long-awaited guide, The Bullet Journal Method, Track the Past, Order the Present, Design the Future. And I got a lot of stuff to ask him because basically it's just a journal with bullet points. And I'm thinking, well, there's lots of apps like that, or you can just write stuff down on a yellow pad, or you got a calendar. So I got to find out what's different about his method. And I'm sure there is something, so I'm looking forward to that one because I'm curious about it. Anyway, for a complete schedule, and we got more coming up that Rebecca's lining up now, so there'll be a bunch more. But for a complete schedule right now, you can go to wellingtonsquarebooks.com, my independent bookstore, which I was just talking about, which is in Eagleview, just off the downtown interchange of the Turnpike. Or you can go to the radio station's website, or you can just download our podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. And if you had the podcast app from iTunes, then if you subscribe, then all of them will propagate down and you'll have all 400 plus hours of me talking, which is quite a task for anybody, but an excellent cure for insomnia. So in any event, thanks for being here, and hopefully you'll be here to join us next week on another edition of The Avid Reader.